curious to know if something like the following has happened to you in your nursing career. Your patient tells you they want to go to the bathroom. They maybe went to surgery. This is their first time getting up, but they're young and healthy, so you decide to be the good nurse that you are and walk them to the bathroom. Once on the toilet, they tell you, God, they just don't feel good. And before you know it, they're slumped over and maybe even hitting the ground. I have been part of so many rapid responses in my career with what I'm sure amount to pretty benign syncope, but the patient really gets the bells and whistles in terms of workup. I'm talking EEGs, chest x-ray, lab tests, and I've always wondered why the workup for these patients and what is going on physiologically that causes patients to pass out. Today, I'm going to share a podcast episode I recorded with Sarah Lorenzini from the Rapid Response Podcast. I'm going to tell a story of a rapid response that I called a few months ago that was somewhat unique and complex and full of great teaching points. By the end of this episode, you'll have a better understanding of what's going on during syncope and treatment options for symptomatic bradycardia. My name is Annie. I've been a clinical nurse for 8 years, and I am curious. I use this podcast to address common clinical questions, share unique perspectives across the healthcare team, and cover what's missed in nursing school. Before we dive into the story of the rapid response that I called, I wanted to start by defining our terms, something you know I love to do on this podcast. So syncope is something we kind of all know intuitively, something that we've seen a lot, but syncope is really defined by four characteristics. So the first being a transient loss of consciousness. Secondly, there's a loss of postural tone, meaning that whoever is experiencing syncope will slump over. Third, it is of short duration. And fourth, there is a spontaneous recovery. So when discussing syncope, we talk about three different types, and I'll start with reflex syncope, which encompasses vasovagal syncope, but also includes situational syncope, including coughing, sneezing, peeing, which we call micturition, pooping, which we call defecation, and post-exercise. So those are the situational syncopes. Also in this reflex syncope category is vasovagal, what we'll be talking about a lot in today's episode. So this can be caused by prolonged standing, emotional stress, blood draws, and severe pain. Usually it's intra-abdominal pain. So what's going on pathophysiologically with reflex syncope is that the vagus nerve is becoming overstimulated in response to a stressful event. So the vagus nerve senses that there's a stressful situation, there's an increase in blood pressure, there's an increase in heart rate, so it works to bring it down, but it overcompensates, overstimulated, so that there is a combination of bradycardia and systemic hypotension, which under these conditions, there is a drop in cerebral perfusion and a transient loss of consciousness. So that's reflex syncope. So moving on, the second type of syncope would be orthostatic. And this is also something that we see fairly commonly in the hospital. It happens when a patient is volume depleted. It can be caused by medication side effects such as beta blockers or autonomic dysregulation like Parkinson's disease. Those patients are very prone to becoming orthostatic. So it just means that there is a transient loss of consciousness due to a sudden change in position, often from sitting to standing. The third type of syncope is cardiogenic syncope, meaning that the reason why the patient had a transient loss of consciousness is due to something going on in the heart. And cardiogenic syncope is the big, scary one, and is the reason why almost all patients who syncopize in the hospital will get an ECG, is because we're looking for cardiogenic syncope. So what are some of the reasons for cardiogenic syncope? The main ones would be arrhythmias. So bradyarrhythmias, like symptomatic sinus bradycardia, AV blocks. Then there's the tachyarrhythmias, the VTACs. And there are also mechanical reasons why, right? So severe aortic stenosis, massive PE, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So with this background in mind, I will share with you my rapid response story.
Annie, tell us about your patient. Tell us about what led up to it, and then the actual reason why you're like, that's it, I'm calling a rapid response.
Yeah. So I had a patient whom I actually called two rapid responses on over two different days. So I'll start kind of from the beginning here. Okay. I had a patient who is post-op TURP, so transurethral resection of the prostate, which is a very common procedure. It's usually kind of in and out of the hospital in, I don't know, 1 to 2 days, like very routine procedure. So I had him, he just came out of PACU. He came to me, and when I was checking his vital signs, I noticed his heart rate looks kind of high, but he looks okay. Maybe he's in pain. You know, I'm just going to kind of keep it in the back burner of my mind. But when I checked his vitals again a couple hours later, his heart rate was still high and it was getting higher. So I said, okay, I'm going to keep the pulse ox on this guy and just kind of keep an eye on that. So then his heart rate kept getting higher and higher. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to slap telemetry on him and see what's going on.
Good forward thinking.
Yeah. And the issue with this patient was that his attending physician, so his primary physician at the hospital, was a urologist, and he was still in OR doing procedures, and he was unreachable. He said he was like in a dead zone in the hospital. Like, I don't know what was going on, but he was unreachable. So I was kind of stuck having concern about this patient who I'd thrown on telemetry. He was second degree type 1 heart block.
Okay.
And this is a new diagnosis for him. He had no known cardiac history before. So in a way, maybe it was like an incidental finding, or maybe the stress of anesthesia had caused him to go into this heart block. So I ended up calling a rapid response because I was stuck with this patient with a new diagnosis of heart block and unable to get hold of a provider. So I called a rapid response because I needed to expedite things. Mm-hmm. I needed a teleorder. I needed 12 lead, you know, I needed someone to start managing this patient's like cardiac status. So that was my first rapid response. And I ended up going home and coming back the next day. And I got this patient back again. He was still in and out of first degree heart block and then second degree heart block, but he was doing okay. He had a hospitalist take over his case. So his cardiac issues were being addressed. He was going to have a cardiac consult. During my shift, he's on telemetry. A doctor comes and talks to him about what's going on with his heart. And I think this is the first time this patient had a talk with a physician that was like this serious about, you know, something as scary as your heart. And he said, you know, I'm not feeling really good right now. And I looked at the telemetry monitor with the physician who's there, and we essentially caught vasovagal syncope on telemetry, which I had never seen before. And the way it manifested with this patient was essentially a 6-second pause on telemetry with P waves. So that's when I called the second rapid response.
And I need y'all to come right on back because we have not fixed this problem yet.
And it was the same rapid response nurse. And I was like, great, we get to hit the ground running here. We know what's going on with this patient. And the physician at bedside said, you know, besides we need to start a bolus wide open, we need to take serial blood pressures on this guy. He said, atropine, we need atropine here at bedside. And the rapid response nurse said, I don't think that's a good idea.
I'm going to interrupt my own story to just touch on atropine and heart blocks here. So We all know atropine from our ACLS classes because it is part of the symptomatic bradycardia algorithm. Atropine inhibits the parasympathetic nervous system by inhibiting the vagus nerve, causing the SA node to increase its rate of electrical discharge. So putting atropine aside for a second, let me talk about heart block. As I said in my story, my patient was in and out of first degree and second degree heart block, which meant that there was a partial block of impulses between his SA and AV nodes. So new onset heart blocks are often associated with MIs, and we are cautioned in our ACLS algorithms to not use atropine when there is a concern for this, because, let's think this through, atropine would increase heart rate in these patients, which would decrease ventricular filling and worsen cardiac perfusion, something you definitely don't want to do in the setting of an MI. Okay, back to the story.
So what did the rep response nurse say as to why atropine isn't your go-to for this patient?
Right. So this rapid response nurse was wonderful. He just sat down, talked to me, and said, look, atropine works on the SA node. And this guy, he has P waves. His SA node is working. Atropine is not the drug of choice here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for a patient who's just having sinus bradycardia, atropine's great. It'll make the atria squeeze more, and then the ventricles will hear the message and they'll squeeze in response. Great. But for someone who has a block, atropine, I mean, you can give it, might not do too much though. It's the issue. So you're almost wasting your time doing intervention that's not actually going to fix the problem. So if atropine is going to increase the atria doing their thing, but there's a block going to the ventricles, we haven't fixed the issue there, right? So right. We need to figure out, why did this guy go into a heart block in the first place? It sounds like he had a reflex reaction to that stressful situation of the doctor talking to him about his heart, and now he's kind of like bearing down. Like that whole seems like that's what's happening with him. So again, would atropine harm? It's hard to say it would actually harm the patient. It just probably wouldn't do anything. So you're just kind of like wasting an intervention.
So Sarah is correct here, because we had already ruled out an ischemic event with this patient when his troponins had come back negative.
Whenever he had this 6-second pause, did he actually syncopize? Did he lose consciousness?
He did not. He was laying totally flat in bed. He had that sense of it coming on. And so we were able to kind of start reacting to it. But I don't think he actually lost consciousness.
Okay, good. I mean, it's because you got it early on, because you already had a Wendteli, you're already thinking in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And before we go too much further, I just want to pause and recognize that nursing intuition that you had day one, where you're like, this is going to be a little more complicated than just a TURP. I think I need some telly on this patient. Mm-hmm. You knew something. Like, obviously you could never predict that the guy would have a second degree heart block. Like, no one's expecting that from your basic TURP procedure.
Right.
But just following the intuition ended up paying off really well. And then also how you said, you know, I tried to get a hold of the doctor. I think a lot of nurses would say, oh, I tried to call the doctor. I couldn't get a hold of him. I did my part. Well, there's always something else you can do, right? And even if the doctor you call doesn't give you what you're wanting, because say it's a urologist and not a cardiologist, right, then you keep being annoying until you get what you want. And I love that hospitals have rapid response teams to be able to come alongside you and provide that resource of another provider that can help advocate and get the patient, you know, what they need. So yeah, just kudos, Annie, for trusting intuition and getting the patient on telly and not being afraid to call a rapid again the next day. I know people are like, I'm sorry, I just called you yesterday. I'm like, no, don't be sorry. Definitely call back. This is a big change. What's going on? What ended up happening? I'm assuming an official cardiology consult. So cardiology had to come see this patient at that point. What was the outcome as far as the intervention for this patient?
Yeah. So after he had his syncopal episode, you know, he had all like the classic syncope findings, like he was hypotensive for a while. We bolused him. He became normotensive, kind of back to baseline. The physician ordered a consult. So electrophysiology came on board, and you know, that doesn't always happen right away. You know, they were also in their procedures that day. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you know, EP came around and said, essentially, like, we're not concerned about this. This is, you know, vasovagal reaction. and he's stable, and we'll see this guy in outpatient workup.
Yeah, I mean, and that's actually okay, right? If we don't have any continued arrhythmias, if his blood pressure is maintaining after a bolus, if his wakefulness is maintaining, then it probably can be worked up outpatient. But it absolutely has to be worked up outpatient because, you know, something's going on there just to make sure he doesn't have like aortic stenosis or heart failure or something else that's kind of potentiating this vasovagal response. But it is common for after surgery when you're already kind of volume depleted, and now you have stimulation of your vagus nerve because you're scared or frightened or overwhelmed or whatever, that combo just often leads to the pause that you saw on the monitor and the syncope. So I'm glad he was in your care whenever it happened.
So my question for you, so this is the first time I ever saw vasovagal syncope caught on telly, so mm-hmm. to speak. What is the normal telemetry finding looking like when patients syncopize? I don't know. Have you seen it before?
Yeah, for sure. Some patients just brady really slow, like they'll brady down into the 20s or 30s. And then that's just not enough cardiac output to get to their brain. So then they pass out. And some patients, like you saw, had the big 6-second pause. So it could go either way. Either way, they get so bradycardic, there's not enough perfusion to the brain, which causes the syncope. And then then the bradycardia causes decreased cardiac output, which leads to hypotension, which is why you were getting low blood pressures for him. So by bumping up your fluid volume, you improve the hypotension and kind of helped perfuse the brain a little bit better that way too. As far as the treatment for patients that are bradycardic, it totally depends on how symptomatic they are and what type of rhythm they are in, right? Mm-hmm. So we treat sinus bradycardia different than we treat, say, like a third or second or third degree heart block. So for some patients just walk around bradycardic. They're just always in the 40s. I want to say Lance Armstrong, he just lives in the 30s. Like that's just his resting heart rate. And he's obviously very stable and healthy. And he does not need atropine and he does not need to be paced, right? He's just fine. But if a patient is nearing unstable, say they're lethargic or about to pass out, or sometimes they'll get pale or diaphoretic or kind of dusky, or then that patient needs a little more than just, oh, let's just watch and see. That patient needs some intervention. If you have a sinus bradycardia, we can give atropine and that will jack up the P waves and give you more beats. It usually works for sinus bradycardia. But if you have a block, like I said, atropine, it's just not as effective. We have to try other things. So we can try epinephrine or dopamine, or we can do transcutaneous pacing. And that's where we put the pads on the outside of the chest. And you have to choose two things. You have to choose your rate, like how fast you want to pace. So say 80 pulses per minute or 90 pulses per minute. You just choose like a dial probably on your defibrillator. And then the second thing you choose is how many milliamps you want to use to shock that chest. So it's not as many as you would use for defibrillation. That would just be terrible to get that every second. Usually you'll start at like 5, 10, 15. You just keep turning up the milliamps until you get what's called capture. And we know a patient has capture two ways. One, we can see on the monitor that every pacer spike produces a QRS complex. So it'd be pacer spike, QRS, like sweet, we have capture on the monitor. Mm-hmm. But you're not done yet because sometimes, just like with PEA or pulses electrical activity, like in a cardiac arrest, sometimes the monitor looks beautiful, but you go to check a pulse and you're like, that is not what I'm seeing on the monitor. So I've had times where I'm like, yay, we got capture. Look, it says 80 on the monitor. But then I go feel a radio pulse and I'm like, nope, that feels more like a 20 something. That does not feel like an 80. So we would say at that point, we have electrical capture, but not mechanical capture. Mechanical meaning the heart is actually squeezing in response to the electrical impulse and actually creating a pulse that you can palpate radially. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think it's an important point to make because we become so fixated on the numbers, right?
Yeah, everyone looks at the monitor.
Right. Everyone's looking at the monitor and they're not necessarily looking at the patient or, you know, feeling for a pulse. Right. One thing I often are like, beating into the heads of new nurses is treat the patient, not the machine.
Amen.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I even have, when I worked in the ER, I had a flight crew bring in a patient who was bradycardic and they're like, yeah, we're pacing. We're at 120 milliamps. We got captured 120 milliamps and, you know, they're doing good, blah, blah, blah. And I'm looking at the patient like, they don't look good. They look terrible. They're pale and diaphoretic and I can't really wake them up. So I go to feel a radio pulse and it was 22. So he was definitely not capturing at 80. But again, the monitor, beautiful. You're like, sweet, look at that. When you looked at the patient, he did not look like he had a heart rate of 80.
Wow.
Anyway, so yeah. So in that case, we had to increase the milliamps. Most machines, oh, I can't speak most. Our machine at our hospital maxes out at 140 milliamps. Every machine, I guess, is a little bit different. So we maxed out to 140. We still did not get mechanical capture. So at that point, we had to place a transvenous pacer, which is where you put in like a giant central line in the neck, and then you feed pacer wires through the central line all the way into the right ventricle. So you actually pace directly at the heart muscle. We're bypassing the chest wall and the ribs and the muscles. You do it right at the heart muscle itself. And you almost always get captured that way, unless you have dead heart, like from ischemia. Then, you know, ischemic cells just don't conduct electricity very well. But so we were able to get captured within that way.
I have a couple of questions about that. So one is, who performs that procedure?
Transvenous pacing.
Yeah.
That would be a cardiologist or an ER doctor or an ICU doctor, someone who's experienced in, we call them floating the wires in the patient.
Floating the wires.
Not something that just any old doctor can do. That's something that you would have to have some critical care training and experience in. Okay. From what I've observed, again, I don't do the procedure. It looks pretty darn easy. It's just as easy as like placing a central line and feeding the wires in sterilely. And then you have a tinier pacer box outside that you would choose the settings for, how many milliamps and how fast you want to pace the heart.
So you said you're talking about like small voltages, relatively speaking, as opposed to like defibrillation. I've never seen this before. Is it small enough that you don't have to sedate the patient? Or, so that sounds uncomfortable, right?
If it was me, I would most definitely want sedation. Most definitely.
Right.
All right. If we are transcutaneous pacing, of course you want to sedate the patient. But sometimes the reason we're transcutaneous pacing is because they're so sick and their blood pressure is so low. And that's the reason why we're jumping to the big guns of transcutaneous pacing. And if you have a blood pressure of 70 over 40, there is no sedation you can give that they're going to tolerate. So sometimes you have to just pace them and say, I'm so sorry. And then once we get a blood pressure back, now we can give sedation. But in the initial part, sometimes you just can't. Like, I was caring for a fellow nurse one time, actually, who I had to pace, and her blood pressure was 70 over 40. And she was like in and out of consciousness. And I just told her, because she was a friend of mine, I'm so sorry I have to do this to you. And she just looked at me. She goes, do what you got to do and save my life. And so we paced her. And after a couple of minutes, her blood pressure came up. And I was like, let's get this sedation on board. I am torturing my friend right now. But it did save her life. So I would never hold off on life-saving interventions for the sake of sedation, because nobody wants that either.
Right.
Save my life, right? I'll handle it. But we would like to sedate them if at all possible.
Once you get into the transvenous pacing, you probably don't need many volts at all, right?
Feel it.
I don't feel it. Mm-mm. Oh, wow.
No, as the ER educator, I was teaching people how to do the procedures because they have to assist the doctor with it. So I actually put my finger on the end of the transvenous pacer to like feel what it feels like. You can barely feel it. I'm like, how does the heart respond to this? Yeah, it's so minor. So obviously your goal is always, let's get a transvenous pacer in just for the comfort of the patient. And because it's less likely to lose capture, there's less factors that would hinder it. Like, if the patient's diaphoretic or hairy or like all those things make it hard for the pads to get good connectivity. But if you're inside the heart, you're pretty much going to get capture. So we would like to do transvenous pacing, but transcutaneous pacing is fast. As fast as you get the pads on and turn the dials up, you can get capture. Whereas transvenous, you have to sterilize, clean the neck and place the central line and pass the, like, it's a whole process. So it takes longer.
Right. And I imagine you might not have like the supplies right there, whereas you have pacing pads like everywhere in the hospital.
Exactly. Yeah. I think in our hospital, the transvenous pacing wires are just in the ER, the ICU, and maybe the cath lab. And that's really all you're going to find them. You're not going to find them like on the med-surg floor or, where else you might have to float the wires to. But
what are some reasons why transcutaneous pacing wouldn't work?
Oh, I love this question. Okay. So I would say start on the outside. What external factors could go wrong? Is the patient really hairy? Do I need to wax that chest? Are they diaphoretic? Do I need to dry them off really good? Do they just have a large body habitus and there's just lots of tissue in between the heart and the pads. All those things can make it more difficult to get capture. And then once you get internally, so now we're looking at like the pathophysiology of the patient. So what are their electrolytes? You know, the whole sodium potassium pump, like if we don't have the right amount of electrolytes, it's hard for the cells to function properly. What is their pH is another big one. Mm. Acidotic cells, they just don't do their job very good. So let's correct the pH. If there's like maybe like a tamponade or something where it's harder for the message to get through. And then the big one is ischemic cells. So if a person's having a heart attack and there's a big chunk of meat of the heart that's dead, it's going to have a hard time responding to those electrical impulses. So that's the big ones that I have seen. So when we're thinking, why aren't we getting capture? Why aren't we getting capture? Think through all those things. Okay. How is the chest on the outside? What do I see that I can fix? How are their electrolytes? Should we give a little amp of bicarbon, you know, bump up their pH a little bit? Like, what can I do to help promote capture for this patient? Because we're getting to the point where we're maxing out our MAs and we don't have any more left to go and we're not getting capture. The patient's crashing. So we're going to be doing CPR pretty soon if we don't get this thing to capture.
Wow. Wow. So I'd almost think like if a patient, you know, is very sick, like you might, as soon as you put on a transcutaneous pacing pad, get ready for the transvenous pacing.
Yeah. I mean, in my career, I've probably only like placed the transvenous pacer like 10 times. Usually transcutaneous does the trick. Like it'll buy you time until they can get to the cath lab where they would prefer to do it in a more controlled environment and under fluoroscopy, right? Mm-hmm. But transcutaneous pacing, in my experience, most often works. I have a handful of stories I could tell you where it didn't, right? That patient that was flown in on helicopter. I've had a couple of patients that they just had so much going on, other comorbidities that were keeping it from capturing. But most of the time, transcutaneous does the trick. Oftentimes, the patients don't care that they're being paced for the first couple minutes until their blood pressure improves because their cardiac output goes up with a higher heart rate. And now their brain's awake and they're like, oh my gosh, what's happening to my chest? So then that's when you get the sedation out.
Yeah.
So do you have any other questions about handling bradycardia from when it's stable to where it transitions into unstable?
No, I think it's important to remember, you know, atropine is the drug of choice for sinus rhythms. Mm-hmm. And then knowing that you can always grab your pads. And then if those don't work, then you do the transvenous pacing.
Exactly. And as far as atropine's appropriateness, sometimes atropine can help with a second degree heart block because there's still some beats that are going through, right? But third degree heart block, those atrial ventricles are not communicating at all. You know, there's like some disconnect with the secondary heart blocks, type one and type two, but with third degree, you're wasting your time with the atropine for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So what did you say in those cases when you have severe heart block, you said epi might be the drug of choice?
We can try epi. If the heart block is so bad that they're symptomatic, we're going to pace the patient.
Got it.
It's the honest truth.
Got it. Yeah.
But yes, epi is another great option. So let's just size like the pearls of today's or the case that you share with me. So the first thing I would say is recognize that your intuition is so valuable. Whatever tapped in your intuition on the first day when you knew something was up, you followed that. And what a great outcome. You will actually catch the rhythm on the monitor. So very good job there. Rather than just trying to manage it with a urologist, you're like, nope, I want a cardiologist and I want the rapid response team and some more people to be on this case. So very good. Just recognizing the value in nursing intuition. And then next is with bradycardia, our treatment totally depends on how stable they are. If they are unstable, we're jumping to the big guns. If they are stable, then we have more time to do diagnostics and watch and wait and see what's going on. But we're not going to stand back and wait and watch someone bradycardic who's unresponsive to us, right? That patient needs intervention very quickly. And then our treatment options range from atropine to epinephrine to transcutaneous pacing. And if that big gun doesn't work, we're doing transvenous pacing. And at that point, if transvenous pacing doesn't work, there's not many other options, to be honest with you. That heart is really struggling at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. We go into the cath lab at that point too. I don't have much experience with this, but if someone's being paced transvenously, will they need to go to cath lab?
Yeah. If they require a transvenous pacer, ultimately they're probably going to end up with a permanent pacer.
Got it.
But the transvenous pacer is a good like in between. Like no one's going home on their transvenous pacer. They have to be transitioned to a permanent pacer.
Good point.
Yeah. Here's your knobs. You just turn this one if you feel a little lightheaded. No. Yeah. So that's one of the big pearls I can take away. Do you have anything that you want to share with my audience as far as like things that you learned from this case or pearls that you want them to remember from this experience?
Yeah, I would say when in doubt, contact your rapid response team. If you don't have the resources you need, a rapid response nurse will bring them there faster.
I hope that this podcast has helped you improve your nursing practice. If you found value in this podcast, please share it with your fellow nursing friends and colleagues. It really helps me to grow the show and to keep producing these high-value episodes for you. If you would like more practice-improving content in between episodes, follow me on Instagram or Facebook at UpMyNursingGame. All right, that's all for today. Keep sharing this podcast with your nursing friends and colleagues. It would really mean the world to me. Claim your free CE credit, and until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.